We are talking today with Kathy Kelly. Kathy Kelly is a three-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee. She is co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence and co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, and has worked to challenge economic sanctions against Iraq by delivering medical supplies to Iraqi citizens. In 1991, she was in Baghdad during the first Gulf War. In 2003, she remained in Iraq throughout the U.S. Shock and Awe bombing campaign, and she is currently working in support of Iraqi refugees located in Amman, Jordan. She is author of numerous articles and author of the book Other Lands Have Dreams, From Baghdad to Pekin Prison, a collection of her writings from war zones and prisons. She spent 1 year in maximum security prison for planting corn on nuclear missile silos and was imprisoned for 3 months for crossing a line at Fort Benning, Georgia. Most recently, she walked 450 miles from Chicago to the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, to challenge and nonviolently resist the U.S. continuing war in and occupation of Iraq. Kathy, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be here.
Start out and tell us about Voices for Creative Nonviolence.
The Voices in the Wilderness was found guilty of bringing medicines to Iraq, and it wasn't very difficult to find evidence of that. We went down to state's attorney's offices and told media and everybody we could what we were doing and why. And I think it was on page 18 of the judge's brief. He said, Judge Bates in Washington, D.C., those who break an unjust law, now interesting that he said an unjust law, should, and now he was quoting the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, should do so, should accept the conditions openly, lovingly, and with a willingness to pay the penalty. And so we told the judge, if you want to put us in jail, we'll go openly and lovingly. We've tried to do that before in other situations, but we won't pay one dime to the war criminals that continue warfare against Iraqi people. So we refused to pay this $20,000 fine. And I don't know what the judge's response was or is. If there was any effort at collection, we don't know about it because there's really nothing to be taken. But we did start a different bank account called Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And at the time, the sanctions were lifted, not because of all of the hard work of Bert Sachs and other people here in Seattle and the Voices in the Wilderness campaigns cross-country. Quite honestly, it was the United States under occupation of Iraq deciding to lift the economic sanctions. We had moved our office to another apartment 2 blocks away and had a new address and a new phone number. So we decided to give ourselves the name Voices for Creative Nonviolence. So we don't want to walk away from Iraqi people. We very much want to see this war end. We want to see the troops come back. We believe that if the troops pull out of Iraq, that in itself will be a step toward the kinds of reconciling factors that are so, so desperately needed in that country, but also it would be a sign that the United States isn't trying to underwrite through military security the dominance of big oil over Iraq's precious resources. So certainly we want to see the war end, but we don't want to walk away from Iraqi people. We have great responsibility in this country to make reparations for suffering caused.
How did you get involved in this work? And how did you specifically get involved with the U.S. campaigns against Iraq?
You know, I was one of those U.S. people who could spell Kuwait, could find Iraq on a map if you gave me a couple minutes in August of 1991, August 2nd, 1990, Saddam Hussein's troops invaded Kuwait. I was very focused on Central America, on disarmament concerns, on working in my own neighborhood amongst people whose basic needs weren't being met. And I, you know, I was kind of scratching my head, what about Iraq? And there was a quick upward learning curve, but I didn't get involved because I knew very much. I think for me, it was more of the counsel of Ammon Hennessy, who said, you can't be a vegetarian between meals, and you can't be a pacifist between wars. It became very apparent that summer of 1990 that the United States was gearing up for a major war, And why, and against whom, and what had these people done to us, and did they have any ability to control the dictator that we had helped install? And if the United States was against dictators, then what about all the ones we'd been supporting in Central and South America? And if the United States couldn't tolerate invasions, then what about Grenada? What about Panama? So there was plenty to say that there's something very fundamentally wrong here. And I wanted to say, look, if we're going to be strong as a peace movement, we have to be willing to take the same risks that the soldiers don't have any choice about. And so I was very interested, is there any peace team that's going to try to actually go over to Iraq? And then lo and behold, there was. And so I applied, and I never heard an answer. And I thought, well, I guess I just don't have the credentials to join this group. And then at the very last minute, I got word, if you can show up in Boston and bring your passport and, you know, a sleeping bag, you'll probably be in Baghdad in a week. And so that's how I went kind of almost tumbling over to Baghdad that first time. And I think it's important for me to acknowledge that I stayed in the region for 6 months. I didn't come back until August. I was there through the war and then in Jordan trying to help coordinate medical convoys. But when I came back to the United States, Iraq had slipped off of almost everybody's radar screen. It just wasn't being spoken of. And even though I knew that children were horribly affected by these economic sanctions, we had tried to do a little 7-day fast in front of the UNDP in Jordan to call attention to it. Even though I'd seen Baghdad without electricity, even though I was perfectly aware that there was sewage backing into people's homes, I came back and got caught up with other things, got involved in other organizing campaigns. I went to Haiti. I went to Bosnia. My dad needed full-time caregiving. He came to live with me. But I let Iraq pretty much go to the far back burners. And so when I think about people who didn't seem to care about hundreds of thousands of children under age 5 being punished to death by the economic sanctions, I have to remember that time in my life when I was letting one year after another go by and thinking, well, you know, there are a lot of things to care about. You can't spread the peanut butter too thin. The bread will rip. And finding my escape hatch from getting involved. And it's really important for me to remember that. But there were two little tiny women, both Roman Catholic sisters. And they and a friend of ours named Jim Douglas, whom I hope you have on this show from time to time, they just wouldn't forget. They kept going back. They were among the very few who would go back to Iraq and carry back with them messages about this terrible trauma being suffered by children, child sacrifice, really. And so finally, after, you know, a number of phone calls from these two women, you know, it's really bad over there and something ought to be organized. You know, they knew that I'd been there and that I was in touch with people who'd gone there before the war, during the war, and immediately after. I mean, we had at least something like a network. And so then finally in 1995, a number of us said, this is it. We've got to either say we're patently not going to do anything about this, or if we're going to do something, just get it started. I guess I want to say it's on my mind very much right now because I look at the United States eyeing Afghanistan as a scene for increased escalated war, looking at Iran as a possibility for war, Pakistan. And, you know, it's very easy for us to say, well, who knows enough about the culture? Who knows enough about the setting? Who has enough contacts to really ever be able to enter in with any kind of peacemaking team that would take risks in these situations? And the answer is probably, well, you know, if you wait till you're perfect, you'll wait a very long time.
How do you define nonviolence?
I like to, especially in this juncture in life, make sure that the ingredients that have to do with living more simply, sharing resources, and preferring service to domination, service of others, that those ingredients are very much part of an understanding of nonviolence. You know, who's ever going to put a gun in my hands? I mean, it's just not going to happen. So for me to say, you know, I'm nonviolent, I would never shoot anybody, well, that's probably not going to be a question in my life, actually. But am I trying on a regular daily basis to change my lifestyle in terms of my approach toward energy consumption and waste? Am I part of a group of people assiduously, deliberately trying to share our resources more equitably, share jobs, share income, share housing space. These are the kinds of questions about nonviolence that are pretty relevant right now for me, and I expect for many of us, living as we do in such a comfortable situation, but such a wrongful one. I mean, we're offering children and grandchildren a delusional future if we think that they're going to keep on going the way we've been going. This train is not sustainable. So I think that truth force, as Gandhi understood it, can help us out a lot to slow down and be ready to look at the truth of our actual situation. Where are we in terms of the degradation of the environment, the depletion of fossil fuels, the contamination of water and the scarcity of water, and the need to develop alternative energies? And then where are we in terms of our wealth and productivity being poured, I mean poured lavishly, massively, into military spending, which, you know, creates weapons that are now being transferred and sold and proliferating all over the world. And again, by any rational, truthful assessment, it would be almost impossible to tell ourselves we're safer, we're more secure. And so nonviolence also has to do with understanding what gives people security in life. Because basically, when people's needs are being met, when they have an economic stake in a community, when they can have some measure of prosperity for their children, I think you don't have to worry so much about attacks and terror and crime. And that's doable. You know, there's enough to go around. We would just have to reform, change our perception of what our rights are as one group of people on the planet, and this planet being one among Lord knows, you know, how much activity could be going on in the universe.
How do you go about selecting the specific actions you're going to take in the different campaigns you're involved with, as well as just like in your personal life?
I wonder if in the business community the word is capacity building or something. I think, you know, you have to look and see what your capacity is, and also some historical remembrance of what tends to work and what doesn't work. I've been really lucky to be with a steady grouping of people who are kindred spirits enough in terms of, you know, really wanting a more peaceful society, wanting to use means of nonviolence, and being very willing to together both live simply and share resources in, you know, our everyday life, but also think through, okay, what can we try to accomplish? And so in December of 2007, one of our youngest members swiveled around in his office chair and said, why don't we walk to the Republican National Convention from Chicago? And it was an idea that had just enough merit to stick, you know, on our collective thought patterns. And then as we worked it through, we thought, yeah, this is something that makes sense for us to do. And there was a lot of energy for organizing what was probably one of the best projects I've participated in terms of a long ordeal-oriented project that wants to achieve a goal of education and outreach.
And what specific things within that really resonated with you and with others?
Well, we had for some time been going to the offices of elected officials, going to the offices of aspiring presidential candidates, and trying very hard to get them to pull those purse strings shut, stop funding the war. And we'd done plenty of talking to people in, just let me say, high places. But we hadn't done so much of interaction with ordinary people. We hadn't gone outside of the city, the urban, so much into the more rural areas. And so we really craved that chance to just sit down with ordinary people. And we had about, on the route, 20 to 25 community forums, plus numerous interactions, just dialogues with people and chances to talk with people who gave us housing. And the people who gave us housing sometimes did not know us. Some neighbor had said, well, there are these people coming, these people, and it was us. And people who might have been predisposed to be suspicious of us or not like us very much ended up liking us quite well. And wanting us to come back to their areas or walking out of town with us for the next several days. So anyway, there was a lot of good, warm interaction. But it was also an education for me. You know, there are people who believe in the rapture, who are very compelled by the Left Behind series of novels about the rapture, who believe that if we weren't at war, that their daughters and the women in their community might be wearing burqas. Ideas that are beyond what I normally would ever consider. I mean, and so I also disagree with each of those ideas. But it's good to be in contact with people face to face. But maybe the most important thing about the walk is that I'm very ready on a rhetorical level to say that if we are serious about resisting militarism in our time, we must be ready as individuals and communities to change how we use energy. Energy for transportation, energy for maintaining our everyday lives. We have to be ready to change that. And so not using cars, you know, a BBC interviewer called us up and said, it was actually 500 miles we ended up walking. 500 miles? Are there no trains? Well, of course there are trains, but we wanted to make that statement that you can walk much greater distances than we're accustomed to and bike and kind of wean ourselves away from the expectation that things have to be done by car, by my individual car, and, you know, get ourselves into a different approach toward consumption of energy.
Would it be fair to say as well our participation in the current economic system, which appears at the moment as we tape this to be somewhat unraveling, certainly the bulk of our taxes go towards our military-industrial complex here in the U.S.?
Well, that's something that's just so amazing to me, that the United States people have been as complacent as we are in devoting, according to Joseph Stiglitz, $3.2 trillion as the price tag he's expecting. And it could go higher for this war in Iraq to continue. And that's just the United States portion of what will be paid. There are trillions of dollars being shelled out by other countries as well because of this war. And, you know, Stiglitz is a Nobel economist. He was working with a Harvard economist, Linda Bilmes. I mean, these aren't people who have, you know, fringe research capacities. They're right there at the core of people deeply respected. And I think somebody told me that averages out to something like $10,000 per person, $40,000 for a family of four. There are numerous families in this country for whom that's a wallop to their personal budgets. And yet there seems to be a high reluctance not to estimate the cost of this war. And, you know, when you look at the cost of families, small towns, we walked through Wisconsin, and the call-up of the National Guard from small-town Wisconsin will involve 3,500 people going forth from their National Guard for combat duty in Iraq in 2009, the largest deployment of the National Guard since World War II. And one of the big forts inside of Wisconsin is called Fort McCoy, and we deliberately walked past that one. And when we were going past it, I believe the National Guard from Washington State was being trained there in readiness for deployment to Iraq, and probably calling forth people from a lot of small towns in the state of Washington. Well, at Fort McCoy, the U.S. Army had built a village to resemble an Iraqi neighborhood, and that would enable the trainees to practice surrounding the village, going on house-to-house raids, breaking down doors, bursting in, overturning furniture, ransacking closets, tying up the men, hog-tying people, putting them outside to await being carted off for interrogations. You know, this is the kind of thing we're training people to do in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And there's so many questions that come with that. What's going to happen to these people being trained in this way when they come back to the United States? And why is this considered some way for us to establish better security for people in the United States? Do we think that people in Iraq are not going to harbor lifelong and generational resentment and anger because of these kinds of treatment that have affected every province and center in southern Iraq. So, you know, who pays for all of this? Surely it's the average American taxpayer. And surely the media would like to distract us with any number of gossipy stories about Paris Hilton or Britney Spears or anything, but have us actually understand what the cost is. But nevertheless, you do see these statistics with a high percentage of people in the United States opposing the war, exasperated by the war. And we heard that also while we were walking between Chicago and St. Paul. So how do we galvanize that sentiment, that anti-war and maybe peacemaking belief into action that could weigh in some way that would challenge the major companies that form the greatest lobbies on Capitol Hill? You know, the number one lobby is the defense lobby. Number two is AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Commission. They've got enormous, enormous power. And I guess I didn't realize till I read Antonia Juhasz that top 20 banks in the United States could combine all of their profits and they still wouldn't touch the profit of the big five oil companies. So those folks can buy political parties. They can buy elections. If we don't exercise very intently and massively our right to free speech and our will to vote. But I say vote with your feet, not just on the day of the election. Keep voting all year long.
So do you think then the pressure points are amongst the citizens as opposed to, because you had spoken earlier about where your organization had talked with people higher up.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you've also done a lot of talking with people in the streets and in their homes.
Well, I should mention that in our conversation with the higher-ups, it was a campaign of civil disobedience. Senator Durbin from my state one day read what we had to say. He called on the cell phone while we were being arrested in his office, and he said, okay, what is it you want me to know? And so we made it very clear, and we faxed him our statement, and it had to do with the escalation of the war in Iraq. At the time, they had just attacked Fallujah, and they were thinking of attacking Ramadi. And so he read what we had to say into Senate testimony. He said a group of people came to my office, and this is what they had to say. He didn't read, you know, how we left his office in handcuffs, but it was clear to me that this means sometimes does reach, we call this whole project the Occupation Project. It does reach people who in some occasions will change their vote. I mean, I strongly recommend that people persist with this idea of going into the offices of elected representatives, but we have to be many more. And that's the wisdom of going door to door, knocking on people's doors, as the Peace Action Campaign is soliciting now many people to knock on doors and to look back to the civil rights movement. You know, how did the sharecroppers, who were among the most dispossessed and humiliated people in this country's history, how did they manage to build such a strong and versatile and massive movement of people demanding an end to the Jim Crow segregation laws, demanding their right to vote? I think it's important to do both. But I also think that in this pretty historic juncture of an election season where, as we tape, we don't know who the next president will be, we should be very ready. If it's Senator Barack Obama, who becomes President Obama, then I think all of the energy that he might have awakened should be readily galvanized into insisting that the visions he held forth, the promises he suggested and pointed to, be presented as something we still want, even after he's, you know, reached the presidency. In Chicago, we're going to set up Camp Hope, and we're inviting people to come from January 1st to 20th. If Senator Barack Obama becomes president, he has a home near a park on the south side of Chicago, and we'll set up camp near his home to say, don't leave us out in the cold, and we'll hold up the promises that we think he could move forward with in those first 100 days. If Senator McCain becomes president, then I think we should all be ready for an increase, a spike in Wartax refusal. I don't think people will want to pay for the goals of a McCain presidency if, in fact, they were themselves campaigning for Barack Obama. And I think we should have a readiness for the United States escalating warfare and crossing into additional borders. So it's a very serious time. We should not think that the November 4th, 5th election time is the end of the line. That's just the beginning of our work.
Do you think the activist community in the U.S. is just too complacent? For instance, it seems like we wait for things to happen and then react to them. For instance, waiting for the outcome of the upcoming election. Mm. You know, when obviously there's a lot of energy that's happening out there and all different kinds for all the people who are being elected, and that people should be getting up and, as you said, you know, voting with your feet and doing things. It seems to me one of the real solutions is people just need to start doing something and getting out of their comfort zones.
Well, I suppose, Michael, if we were to imagine that we were the elected officials, you and me, and we were trying to assess just how much of a rock the boat capacity is, how much discontent is there out there with policies, with maintaining the status quo, maintaining policies that benefit the United States in terms of exercising military dominance over other people's countries or taking other people's resources at cut rate prices. How badly do people want to stop that? I suppose you might get the impression that actually the message being communicated to elected officials, if we were among them, would be, you know, do what you have to do. Just don't tell us about it too much. But really, we like the way we live. And if you can keep it up, we'll keep you up. We'll keep you in office. That seems, I think, often to be the trade-off, that people subtly communicate that they like things just the way they are. It's irrational as heck. I mean, you know, the train is going over an abyss and we're all riding on it saying, gee, we really like looking out the windows. Gee, this is a nice ride. We don't want to get off. We don't want to change it. We don't want to stop it. But you can't see, you know, a massive discontent being expressed to elected officials. And it's odd, isn't it? Because the risks are not that great. You know, if you go over to Maria Cantwell's office or to the office of an elected representative at any level and maybe sit there and say, I'm not prepared to leave until you give me a satisfactory answer to my questions, and, you know, maybe risk arrest even. You're not going to have a death squad at your door. You're not going to find that your neighborhood will be subjected to massacre. You're not going to find your relatives tortured. You're not going to have much consequence at all beyond inconvenience, really. And if you go to prison, I've done that. I don't look unhappy or damaged, I don't think. And it was actually quite a learning experience. You learn about the onerous length of sentencing that poor people particularly are subjected to, that breaks apart their lives and their futures and their family networks. So that's important education. So why don't people take bigger risks? I imagine the comfort is pretty seductive. And yet, you know, you find people whose closets are full of stuff and they can't manage the amount of belongings they have, and sometimes maybe are running too fast on a, you know, what seems like a treadmill, trying to keep up with the payments for all of the demands that our way of life require. And, you know, I think slowing down and simplifying could make people more happy. But it takes some leadership, I suppose. We could hope that universities and faith-based groups and workers' unions could collaborate more toward a more sensible way of living.
Well, it may be the system we're participating in will bring us that outcome regardless if things continue to unravel, at least at the economic level.
Yeah, I suppose there's an Arabic phrase that's, I'm sure, got counterparts in every language. The closer you are to the bottom, the less far you have to fall. But certainly these are unsettling times, and I hope that fear won't be an overwhelming response It seems to me courage is, everybody feels fear, but courage is the ability to control fears. And I hope that people, particularly those who have a history within the peace movement, will find that kind of courage to take, you know, a lemon and make lemonade out of it and say, you know, this may be a way to guide ourselves into a different way of life, that one that might be more sensible and maybe more enjoyable.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. I wanted to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Michael.